am kind of on this personal programming that is like, I just want to build movement and community for Indigenous people and Juneau within the ski and snow sports industries.
I'm Mike Janes. I'm the lead avalanche forecaster at Alaska Electric Light and Power in Juneau, Alaska.
My name is Ellen Bradley, and my Thinkit name is Kakin Chi.
And I'm Jocelyn Aranda Jackson, and you're listening to Avalanche Hour Podcast.
You are tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour Podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. I'm your host, Brooke Shiny Edwards. The Avalanche Hour Podcast is proudly presented by Vissen Avalanche Control, safety through innovation. With additional sustaining support from Gordini, we keep you outside longer. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge, and news amongst people with a curious fascination of avalanches. While at ISSW this past fall, I caught up with Public Utilities avalanche forecaster and avalanche instructor Mike Janes of Juneau, Alaska. We were both remarking about what a male-dominated space this industry generally falls into, as was indicated by ISSW in the conference space, and he shared with me his remarkable connection with an Alaska Native regional corporation, where he started an internship in partnership with Sea Alaska Heritage to try to engage more Indigenous people in the public forecasting process and the snow and science avalanche world. As he shared with me more about Jocelyn, a young Indigenous woman born in Juneau who took on his internship, I was inspired to invite them to the podcast. Now a first-year student at the University of Alaska Southeast, Jocelyn entered in with 3 credits because she earned them during her internship last year for her research involving tree coring to understand the avalanche history of Juneau. She also simultaneously earned her Rec Level 1 from the Alaska Avalanche School by doing the winter-long internship. To make this internship more meaningful, Mike thought it was important to invite in a mentorship role. To fill this unique opportunity, enter in the beautifully eloquent Tlingit professional skier, Ellen Bradley, who had recently journeyed home to ski on her traditional lands. Ellen joins us today now for the conversation that begins to investigate how the world of snow science could learn from the traditional knowledge and oral histories of Indigenous people. And now a word from the sponsors of this episode.
Additional support for today's episode is provided by Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access.
Here we go, dropping in with Ellen, Jocelyn, and Mike. Welcome, everybody. It's so great to have gathered all of you Alaskans here in the same virtual room together. Ellen, Jocelyn, and Mike, thanks for joining us today on the Avalanche Hour podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, I think to start off with, because there's so many of you, let's just get a short intro from each of you, just hearing, starting with Mike, like what brought you into the snow and science world, starting from when you were a kid up to where you are now, without it being a 4-chapter series.
Sure. I got into the avalanche and snow realm kind of not really intentionally. I started playing in the snow around Juneau here in Tlingit Ani, and it was just, I started venturing further and further, and I was like, I should probably take an avalanche class. And so I took a rec avalanche class from Bill Glute at the university here, and those classes back then were like 3 weeks long and more like a university oriented class. And it just, I like science. And so that kind of like roped me in to the snow, and I just kind of kept doing it and kept taking more classes. And eventually there were job opportunities. And at one point I had to decide, was I going to go through a master's in teaching program, or was I going to take a field tech job working, doing avalanche work here in Juneau? And I made the decision to take the avalanche job, and that was a big fork for me. And so then I ended up working in that field and eventually, you know, worked into the job that I have now, running the avalanche program here at ALMP, and also doing some instructing for the Alaska Avalanche School.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike. What about you, Ellen? What brought you into the snow world? How did you get your start?
I got into skiing at about the age of 4. Both of my parents kind of started skiing in their early 20s. When they were young adults, it wasn't something they'd done most of their life, but they were both in the Seattle area at the time, and kind of it was the thing to do to get out in the Cascades and go ski. And I think when they had kids, when they had my brother and I ended up being this really important family activity for us to do. I grew up, you know, away from my traditional homelands in the Seattle area. And I think both my parents kind of saw skiing as this way for them and for us to have this connection point to the land that we grew up on. They took us to Stevens Pass in Washington and the Cascades as much as they possibly could. And just slowly through surely throughout my life with skiing, like I got more into backcountry skiing, got outside of the resort, and then kind of got pulled into the outdoor industry about like almost 3 years ago now in this kind of strange pseudo professional skier realm. And that's what ended up actually bringing me back home to Tlingit'ani to ski for the first time in my ski homecoming story. And that was back in January of 2021. And that first trip was kind of what led me to working on this internship, getting to meet Mike and getting to work with Jocelyn, and some of the other work that I've been doing in Southeast Alaska around skiing. It all stems from my parents seeing this as this important thing for us to do, and then me kind of taking that and running with it and figuring out how skiing can be this tool for connection to the land, and also this tool to like land back and indigenous sovereignty and connection with our home and with our places.
What a beautiful homecoming. Welcome home. And Jocelyn, what about you?
So I think from the beginning of my skiing journey, it started out with school, because through in Montessori, at least, you have to go skiing like once a year. They take you up there. And this was when I was in first grade. So I was like, this is totally what I want to do. And it turned into this like competition with my siblings. And we joined into the Books to Boards ski group for middle schoolers. And that was really nice. I think that really helped me get into where I am now with skiing. And I think what helped me a lot more with skiing was this whole internship and better understanding what skiing could be like, backcountry skiing and all that kind of stuff, because I don't think I would have been able to do that if I didn't join this internship, which was an amazing opportunity.
And Juneau is where you grew up?
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, welcome. Well, that leads us into exactly what is the internship. And Mike, if you can explain a little bit how the internship came to be and like your role as a public forecaster and what you saw that that need for an internship in Juneau to be.
Sure. Yeah. So there's actually, for how the size of Juneau, there's actually quite a few avalanche professionals in a town of this size. And I also work for the Alaska Avalanche School, and I would, you know, so I spend some time teaching, and I have lots of good friends and networks in the Anchorage area. And one thing I noticed between Juneau and Anchorage, especially initially, was that there's like so many strong female avalanche professionals in, you know, the South Central, greater South Central Alaska area. And in Juneau, there just weren't a lot of women in the avalanche field. You know, it was all men, pretty much male dominated down here with a few exceptions. And then I started thinking more about that. And it was just like, you know, I'd go to these ISSWs, these snow conferences. And like, you know what I'm talking about, Brooke, like we're just at the ISSW in Bend and like, it's almost completely white dominated. And I just started thinking more about like, well, why is this, you know? And at first, you know, I think I didn't have a good understanding of some of the things that are driving some of this. But, you know, I think one thing that was interesting with this internship with Jocelyn that really came to light for me is like the cost of entry for these kinds of things and giving the opportunity to be even able to understand that like skiing is something that you can do, you know, for kids to have that opportunity to be even told that they, that skiing is something they can do and give them the resources to do it is a pretty heavy lift, and it's not necessarily really happening in a lot of places. And so with this internship, one of the things I learned, when Jocelyn first started, like she didn't have backcountry gear, right? And it had been a long time since I completely helped anybody get outfitted from scratch with a backcountry touring setup. And it's not cheap, right? It's so expensive. So if like just from one little thing is like financially, a lot of people can't afford to get into it. And so like in this case, Fairweather Ski Works in Haines and Foggy Mountain here in Juneau and Sea Alaska Heritage chipped in some. I mean, it was like, and Ellen used some of her sponsors as well to get equipment. I think Deuter and Smith also helped us with some goggles. We kind of just like shotgunned the whole thing. And in the end, we were able to make it happen, right? But like gear and equipment is one thing. But even taking that a step further back, it's like a lot of kids just aren't even being given the opportunity to go skiing, because it's like giving them a pass is like only one little piece of the thing. How do they even get up to the mountain? And then they have to get gear and all that stuff. And so like, you know, Ellen can talk more about that because she's been involved with the Douglas Indian Association, who's running a program to get like youth, Native Alaskan youth involved in skiing so that they can like start seeing that this is something, you know, whether you want to do it professionally or not, like allowing kids to see like this is something that you can do and give them the resources that they need, including like rides to the hill and the gear and instruction and all that stuff that costs so much money and takes time, I think is just really lacking in, I'd say, probably most spaces in our country anyway.
Definitely, Mike. And I'm so grateful for you being an ally as a white male in the industry. And we did have this conversation looking around ISSW, and it's nice to see how many more women have entered the field, and yet still it's such a predominantly white male space. So I appreciate you as an ally looking out and looking up and looking forward as to what are some of those barriers to entry and identifying those and then starting to take them apart piece by piece. So Mike, which came first? Did you reach out to Ellen first, or did you open up the internship and Jocelyn applied and then you reached out to Ellen? Just explain kind of how the process shook out.
Yeah. So I didn't know Ellen or Jocelyn when we were first hatching the idea for the internship. I am friends with one of the directors at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and they've been running summer internships for a little while now. And, you know, we were like, well, is there any reason we can't run a winter one? And of course there were some logistics that needed ironed out and whatnot. And she said, yeah, well, let's do it. We haven't done it, but we can do it. And Jocelyn was in one of their summer programs, and they kept saying, this girl keeps talking about skiing. It's like 70 degrees in summer or whatever, and she just won't stop talking about skiing. And so that's where Jocelyn came into the picture. And as the internship was gearing up, I found out that there's also this mentorship program, which is sort of separate from the internship program. And I didn't know Ellen, but my friend Kanan, who also works with me and helps out with this internship program at AELNP, he's worked with Ellen on film projects. And so that's kind of how that came together. I reached out to Ellen, and she was more than willing to take part. Because for me, it's like, I'm certainly happy to be an internship host, but I think, and I should let Jocelyn and Ellen both speak for it, but I think there's huge benefit of having a Native Alaskan, especially female mentor in the picture as well, because there's things that I just can't provide for Jocelyn that somebody like Ellen can. And so to me, I feel like it's kind of a crucial integral piece of it. So it's kind of, it's sort of a combined mentorship and internship, if you will. And it was nice because a lot of times we're all of us able to go in the field together. So we're all learning from each other.
And Ellen, for you, when you were first presented with this opportunity, what spoke to you? What spoke to your heart about joining this opportunity to mentor Jocelyn?
Yeah, I remember it took me a while to get back to Mike when he had first reached out to me. At first, I was just like, who is this random white man in Juneau emailing me, asking me about like skiing and wanting to have a conversation? And yeah, I remember taking a minute to respond to that. And it took Kanan calling me one day and being like, Mike is a good man. You need to respond to this email. Just like have a conversation with him. And I trust Kanan's opinion on people pretty strongly. And so I was like, Kanan's probably right. And I remember talking to Mike the first time about this and just thinking, this is such an awesome opportunity. At the time, and still, I am kind of on this personal programming that is like, I just want to build movement and community for Indigenous people in Juneau within the ski and snow sports industries. We have Eagle Crest really close by. It's an awesome mountain and not enough Native people have access to being there. And so like within that first trip I took in January 2021, that was my takeaway of the trip, was just we need to build capacity in whatever ways we could. And there, go for it.
I was just going to say, will you speak to that a little bit more? Because I'm curious to know what you've done with the Douglas Indian Association and how you've taken that drive and run with it.
Yeah, so after our first trip, and I should say, like the first trip we did, we were sent by Patagonia to write a blog within what they call their cleanest line, which is their blogs, about my ski homecoming. And like, we went up just essentially wanting to tell the story of what it was like to be a Tlingit professional skier who had never skied at home in this place that is Alaska, where the ski industry just, you know, upholds it as the pinnacle of skiing, the place you have to go, and really sets this standard of like what that looks like. And being a person who whose blood, whose genetics, whose people come from this land and know that those representations of Alaska aren't accurate was something that really brought up a lot of intergenerational trauma for me being in this industry. And so I came and wanted to tell this story for myself, and to figure out what does that look like? What does skiing on your homelands when you never have before look like as a Tlingit person who is a very proficient skier who exists in this industry? And the biggest, as I said, the biggest takeaway that I had from that trip was like, we don't have the same access to our own homelands as other people do. And it kind of spurred this movement that I had with some other folks. At first, it was Katie Riley, who was an awesome ally living in Sitka, works for the Sitka Conservation Society. And then Marina Anderson, who's just the most badass Tlingit and Haida woman, who's now the director at Sustainable Southeast Partnership. And a few other folks in the Juneau area of just like, okay, how do we do this? How do we build youth programming? And kind of pushed forward to June of that year. And we all met up again in Juneau for Celebration, which is the Sea Alaska Heritage huge party that happens every other year, and kind of led to more conversations. How do we make this happen? How do we make this happen? And we had one more meeting where we were informed that the Douglas Indian Association that year had started a program. It was really small to start, but like they had started it kind of around the same time in parallel that we had all been talking about wanting to create a program like this. And so that kind of spurred this journey that brought me back home in December of 2023 to kind of working on these programs. And ultimately, when I had that conversation with Mike about this internship, I was like, that's another piece of this puzzle. Like, it's one thing to get people out on skis in the resort at Eagle Crest to get the kids out, but it's also a whole other thing to increase avalanche education and safety and access, and decreasing some of those barriers, especially to the cost of gear for our people. Because Eagle Crest is awesome, but one of the most awesome things about Eagle Crest is its access to backcountry. And if you don't have that education, if you don't have the backcountry gear, you can't get out in that and experience that. And I think especially as Tlingit people, we have a strong traditional ecological knowledge about what it means to move through these landscapes in the winter. there are a ton of stories that talk about how advanced our knowledge of avalanche, of snow safety, of our mountains are. And I think that that's something that that kind of knowledge, we don't have as much access to that within our own communities, because things like an Eagle Crest or the outdoor recreation industry exist on our land and kind of, in a lot of ways, have prevented us to be active participants of that traditional ecological knowledge. And so for me, backcountry skiing is such a beautiful way to keep living in that, to keep developing that knowledge, to keep practicing it and keeping it alive. And when Mike said what the internship was, it just had me super excited. And I was like, I'm going to be in Juneau this winter. Either way, anytime I am in town, anytime around, like, I want to be there. I want to be supporting this. I also want to learn how to do a better job at digging snow pits and reading the snowpack. And so I thought it was just such a cool opportunity to both be a mentor in that space and also to still reciprocally be a mentee as well.
It sounds like a beautiful relationship. And I love the one you're describing of coming back to your homeland as well. So we'll circle back in a little bit to some of the ideas you have about getting more Indigenous peoples access, because I think there's a lot of good brainstorming to be done in that zone. But first, I want to hear from Jocelyn a little bit as to what it was like for you to enter, like, how did you, it sounds like you'd been talking about snow all the way through the summer. So people had identified that you were the girl who would be perfect for this job. And what was it like for you coming on into this internship, both in your relation with Ellen and with Mike, and entering this whole new world of backcountry skiing, from getting the gear to getting out in the mountains and digging snow pits?
I think the whole thing, so what I think makes me so passionate about skiing is, like, you know how there's seasonal depression and, like, that whole thing, that does happen to me quite often, but it, like, when skiing comes around, I'm like, okay, bye, like, bye depression, see you later, like, when the leaves fall and it's constant rain and constant, like, darkness, I'm just, like, praying for the snow to come so I can finally, like, deal with my seasonal depression the right way, like, skiing. Backcountry skiing was a huge eye-opening thing for me, because that's something I never imagined myself doing. And I'm, like, super duper appreciative of that opportunity. And that's one thing I did talk about a lot during the Sled Scene Camp, which is the camp that we that Mike was talking about earlier, that I would not stop talking about skiing. Because that's one thing we were talking about, is traditional healing. And my version of traditional healing is skiing. So, yeah, that's something I definitely rely on heavily. So that's probably why I was talking about it so much. And the transition from, like, alpine skiing, going up chairlifts and going back down, to hiking up, like, a mountain and then skiing down, is so, like, it's so big for me, because, like, with you're just hiking up a mountain and it's like, wow, I could just ski down with my skis. I don't know. It was just great. And one, branching off of what Ellen was talking about earlier, and what Mike was talking about earlier, the financial burdens, Books to Boards is definitely something that, like, helped me a lot with being able to continue my skiing passions. It's a middle school group that works on just being it. You're just free to go up there. You just have to keep your grades up, that kind of stuff. And they have weekly meetings. I've probably forced both of my younger siblings to go through that. But they do now go skiing a lot. So, thanks to the Books to Boards group for that.
Cool. Do you think that as you have gained knowledge in the backcountry and that whole world has opened up to you, do you foresee maybe a future group of books to boards that perhaps does some avalanche awareness leads in there, kind of builds that bridge to the backcountry so that it isn't just Eagle Crest that you're opening the doors to now that these doors have opened to your broader mountain range in your backyard? How do you see like maybe utilizing this experience you've had to maybe transfer that out to the next generation coming up?
Yeah, I'd love to try to make that group a lot more than it is. Although it is a lot, like being able to get rentals for free, being able to ski up there for free, getting like coupons on food up there for free through games that you do at the meetings every week. Yeah, I think doing some backcountry introduction to the Books to Boards group would be amazing. I'd love to help that. Yeah, I think if there was an opportunity for me to go back to Eagle Crest, I'd probably go into the Books to Boards and help them out.
I think it would be really cool if you just even shared with those kids what your experience was in the internship too. For you, sticking with Jocelyn, I want to hear, I know that you ended up like, was this internship in the last season, basically 2022? And if you can explain, like, I think you ended up doing some tree ring research that if you can explain a little bit more about that project, because that was certainly something that was the hot topic at ISSW. It's the up and coming sciencey thing to do with avalanches. So Jocelyn, what did you work on with the tree rings?
So with the tree rings, we use a tree coring tool. I forgot what they call them. Mike knows for sure. But it's basically like a drill piece that you go and drill through the tree, and it sounds like knocking on the wood when you're drilling into the tree, or at least it should, or else it's like moldy within the tree. And the whole reason and the whole like backstory for tree rings and tree cores is there's disturbance within the tree rings with like avalanches that you could tell throughout the years, since trees are usually over like 100 years old. We could date back and see how often an avalanche occurs in the area or when the last major avalanche was there. Yeah, that's what I know about the tree rings.
Well, and that's awesome. And I think it would be cool is like that's the snow science nerd approach to seeing the avalanche history. But I loved what Ellen spoke to earlier when you spoke about that the oral histories of your people have been living in these mountains amongst snow and avalanches for thousands of years. And what have you discovered, Ellen, amongst the stories of your people? And how do you see that, like, how could we incorporate perhaps oral traditions and perhaps marry them into a snow and science capacity? Where do you see an entry point for those two worlds to collide and interact and engage with the stories of the mountains and the people?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of the like first places we could start in incorporating the two is within language. Like the Tlingit language is very well documented. We have incredible speakers in the Juneau area who have a really strong understanding of language. And I think inherent to most indigenous languages is traditional ecological ecology about places. And I think like starting in the ways that we describe snow or avalanches or weather patterns that we have in this Occoquan, in this Juneau area, would be such an incredible place to start. We're seeing that in other places. I have a really good friend who's Yakima, and he is a mountain guide in the like on his traditional homelands, but in the Seattle area and within the Cascades. That's something he's been advocating for a really long time, and like area education is the use and incorporation of indigenous languages and how we talk about snow science and how we talk about understanding the mountains.
I think that would be amazing.
Yeah, so I think that's a good place to start. And then also just, I think language would be a good place to start. And then another great place, of course, is to think about stories and to think about the stories of these places. And I think Mike can touch on that for one of the avalanche paths that we were analyzing this year.
Mike, is there a story there about an avalanche path in Juneau? Well, there's so many avalanche paths in Juneau.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way to, like, yeah, it's interesting because sort of what Ellen and Jocelyn were talking about, these, you know, the language is so much more descriptive, and it's like more than just putting the name of a person on some feature that, like, maybe never even lived here. Like, that's so useless as far as understanding what's going on in the place. And so the one of the biggest avalanche paths in Juneau, people know it as Snowslide Creek. It's on Thane Road. It's a DOT controlled avalanche path. You know, it's got almost an annual frequency of hitting the road, destroys our power lines, you know, every 10 years or something like that. the descriptive Tlingit word for that talks more about how the owls hunt in this area, because in the spring, because the avalanches are constantly taking all the trees out in the lower reaches of the slope. And so what happens is it's open. And so you get like voles and mice and all these kinds of small critters feeding in there. And so the name translates to the snow slide of the little owl, because the owls will hang out there in the spring and hunt the little mice and stuff that come out. And it's because the avalanches are constantly regenerating this landscape that it creates this type of ecology. And so, you know, that level of description, you know, you can look at lots of other places and that have similar type names. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we've been trying to learn, because we want to put this kind of stuff in our maps and start using these names, because they're so much more meaningful. And they can teach us a lot about what's been going on in these places.
That's so phenomenal. And I would hope that people listening to this podcast all over the world are on lands where Indigenous peoples have always existed. And perhaps it's something that they could start researching themselves about, like, in any place that there are snow and avalanches and there people are living, then it is worthwhile to contact the Indigenous peoples that have lived there for so many years for those stories, because I think that is just an incredible way to gain the history of, and indeed almost more effective than doing the tree coring, in my mind, you know, in such a more beautiful, poetic, honoring way as well, to actually give voice and give honoring to the first peoples who came before everyone else. So
I would like to add one tidbit to that, and Ellen could maybe elaborate on it, which is like one of the really important things, like when we're working in this space, is to always make sure that we're asking permission and talking to people, because usually these stories, like, we don't own them. I certainly don't. Maybe somebody does. And so we have to be careful. And it's for good reason, because there's plenty of stories where anthropologists came up here and they scraped up everyone's stories and information. And then they go and they publish it and then they own it. And then they turn around and they're making money off of it. And so, you know, it's, you have to walk a balance with that, because there's been a lot of wrongs done in the past. And so people are very protective of that knowledge. But I think if you go about it correctly and you show interest and you talk to people, that's not really an issue, as long as your intention is correct and you're just asking permission when you start to talk to people about it. Because there has been a negative history around a lot of that, where people are basically coming in and stealing people's knowledge and information and then trying to rebrand it as their something they discovered, you know.
Exactly. And thank you so much, Mike, for bringing that up. And you see that, I'd love to even have that as a segue back to Ellen, because there's a lot of questions I have just for our greater audience about how to You know, a lot of times people are nervous about entering that space of being an ally. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They want to know is like, what are your feelings around people tagging Indigenous lands on Instagram? Is, you know, is that looked down upon? Is it a good way to start? What are some different things like that, that people can start to have, you know, land acknowledgements in the spaces they're working? What are some ways that they can, you know, as white males, as white females, as anybody who is non-Indigenous, like if you can explain a little bit more your concept of what Indigenous means to you, Ellen, and then how any advice you have for us as allies to our greater audience.
Yeah, so I think Indigenous to me is a term that kind of breaks down these colonial borders that we, that our government has subscribed to this day. So like for me as a Tlingit woman, I don't identify as a Native American because I don't identify one as an American. I don't subscribe to the United States colonial project that is an active occupation of this land. And I think like historically you more often see Native American referencing Indigenous people, tribal nations of the lower 48 of the continental US outside of Alaska and out of Hawaii and other territories of the United States. And I'd say territories with finger quotes. But I think like for Indigenous people, you know, the ultimate thing that you can do is if you are talking in a more broader scale, it's to use the word Indigenous more often than it would be to use, especially not to use the word Indian or often not to use the word Native American or like less. There's people who definitely have different opinions on that, but that's kind of how I feel. And the end all be end all, as often as you can, referring to people as their tribal nation, as where they identify and where they belong, is kind of this recognition of like pan-indigeneity is only helpful as a tool of solidarity, as a force for sovereignty across Indigenous nations. But if you too often group all Indigenous people together, you ignore the very vast and diverse cultures and languages, value systems, governments, and people that we are. So more often when I introduce myself first as Tlingit. And then if I'm talking about issues that affect Indigenous peoples of the Americas, I will talk about being Indigenous. And I think like that's how I feel. I think that's how a handful of folks that I talk with also feel, but I don't think that everyone who is Indigenous or Native feels that way. And I think what's useful in telling you that is like, sometimes you just have to ask people how they identify or how they would like to be identified. And I think that's one of the first advice I would give to allies is you are probably going to say something wrong if you are interacting with Indigenous nations. And I think to some extent, that isn't your fault. In this country we live in, our education system does not give you the tools to know how to talk to people across different cultures, different cultural backgrounds, different geopolitical backgrounds. And I would say, don't allow your fear that you are going to say something wrong stop you from trying to create these relationships. Because I think at the end of the day, what we need is solidarity between our different groups. I think, especially within the United States, within Canada, within North America, we just need to find more solidarity between these different groups that are all facing different kinds of oppression as a result of living under an occupation, a colonial state that is the United States under capitalism. Like none of these systems actually function and uplift all of our lives and create our lives to be better. So I think finding solidarity within that is helpful. And I think ultimately finding out whose land you are living on, I think a land acknowledgement is a start. I don't think it is the end of your allyship. And I think when it comes to kind of like what Mike was talking about, stories, I think the first step in order to like learn Indigenous stories is to like meet Indigenous people, to be in these spaces and develop relationships. And I think too often in workspaces, we see people wanting to work with Indigenous people, finding that allyship, wanting to work on projects with them, and they forget that you first need to have a relationship to people to understand their wants, their needs, their identities before you prescribe on a whole group of people what you think it is that we need. So that's my like how to be an Indigenous ally 101 in a very quick wrapped up box.
I absolutely love it. Thank you, Ellen. I really appreciate it. And it seems like it's really important to your identity as a professional skier that it's very, that you're bringing that forward in your identity as a professional skier as well, and utilizing that platform to shine light into the voice of Indigenous peoples. And hopefully through just you being on the screen and being showcased as a professional skier, that other young women like Jocelyn growing up can see themselves in you, and hopefully the younger women under Jocelyn can see themselves in her, and will continue to have that. Because so often that's the case, right? Is like we need to see ourselves in a zone before we can believe. And so for you two in particular, I just applaud your courage in stepping into a world that has been traditionally white and traditionally male, and breaking the barriers and breaking the glass ceiling, and moving forward with courage and honor and beauty that you both shine on. So thank you for that. I'm curious, before we wrap up the show, just if any of the three of you would like to share a story from a day that you were out together in the mountains, a fun day that you all had, or an exciting day, any field days that stand out from the 2022 season last year, working together out there in the mountains.
Does anything stand out to you, Jocelyn?
I think the first day that I actually got to go backcountry, because there's a lot of powder, and that's something that I don't really experience, just, you know, skiing on already groomed snow. I fell like multiple times. And I mean, I've had powder days, but I haven't had powder days where there wasn't already groomed snow below the powder. So that's like the first thing that could that stands out to me.
And were you hooked? We loved the falling down face shots over and over again.
It doesn't hurt. It's perfectly fine. And then you just get right back up, back into the powder.
What was the learning curve for you like with like getting all new backcountry gear, everything? There's so much to learn. Were you like, how were you dealing with the overwhelm of like new gear, skiing powder, digging snow pits? Like, that's just a lot.
Yeah. I did go through some videos about the things that we're learning out outdoors and on field. There were pre-recorded videos of a course that was going to that was going through the avalanche classes that were the previous year, because it was a COVID year, and everything was recorded, and I got to go through that and better understand what we were doing on the field. One big thing for me was the probe. That was probably my most favorite thing, was the probing, because I can actually see how deep the snow is, and I didn't really think that the snow was going to be that deep. I was oblivious to like how much snow I was like stepping on. So yeah, I thought that was pretty cool to see.
Well, I want to thank you all for taking the time to be with us today on the Avalanche Hour podcast, and for shining light, most importantly, on how Indigenous cultures can perhaps shed an ancient and a new light into snow science. And thank you, Mike, for even having the foresight to see where, as a white male, you could be an ally in the snow science world to maybe open some of those doors, and particularly living in Alaska, where the Indigenous cultures are alive and well and very much a part of the land and the culture and the town of Juneau. So thank you, Jocelyn. Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Mike, for your time here on the show. And for any of you out there listening, if you want to give any of these a follow, we'll have some show notes to all the the internship and all the different associations that we mentioned, and different ways to increase your own knowledge on the Indigenous lands that you're currently living on. So thank you all.
Yeah, thank you for letting me get onto this podcast. It's super cool.
Thanks, Jocelyn. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Mike, Jocelyn, and Ellen as much as I did. I feel like it was far too short a conversation for the topics we discussed, and it has me curious to learn more about how we can open the door in snow science to incorporate existing Indigenous knowledge. For more information and a link to their collective research poster on using tree core samples to understand avalanche frequency in Juneau, Alaska, check out the show notes. If you want to continue to follow any of their adventures, you can also find their individual Instagram handles on those same show notes. And while you're at it, go ahead on over to Instagram and Facebook and give us a follow at the Avalanche Hour Podcast. Or if you'd like to give us any feedback at all, go ahead and send us an email at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com. In need of some new gloves, socks, or goggles? Go check out Gordini.com and use the code theavalanchehour10 to get 10% off and free shipping on your next order. Are you an industry professional? Gain access to even deeper discounts on Gordini products through Expert Voice. Music for this episode was provided by Ketsa at ketsa.uk. Artwork was created by Mike T, whose work can be found over at his website, miket.com. A big shout out goes to Cameron Griffin and Caleb Merrill for producing this show and for inviting me to guest host. Until next time, get out there, shrub that lovey love, and just remember, we are all in this together.